KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I was the one who's like, you know, taking 5 years to edit a skate video, and it's like, oh, I want to be in Bing's video. So when I came back, they were probably really psyched to be filmed by me, and then probably weirded out that I wanted to follow all these other aspects of their lives.
Growing up in Rockford, Illinois, a town outside Chicago that's seen better days, director and cinematographer Bing Liu was obsessed with making skateboarding videos with his friends. Over the course of 12 years, one of those mini-movies morphed into the coming-of-age documentary, Minding the Gap. This week, we revisit our conversation with Liu. He tells KCRW's Matt Holtzman about following friends and their fractured families, camera in hand, to make Minding the Gap, which was nominated for Oscar and is now a Peabody Award winner. But first on the News Banter, at the upfronts, Disney presents a lavish Golden Corral buffet, and CBS has an awkward bacon and egg breakfast. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my companion in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So the upfronts have been underway in New York. This is where, in the distant past, when we didn't have a gazillion channels and streaming services, the broadcast networks would gather advertisers in gigantic venues, and they present the fall programming, and the advertisers would then sort of decide where they really wanted to put their money and place their bets. Now these upfronts are transformed. It is really, really crazy. One thing that has not changed, however, is that Jimmy Kimmel does a set. I mean, now CBS has Stephen Colbert and NBC has Seth Meyers doing jokes. However, Jimmy Kimmel is the king of this. He does it better than anybody. I will just give you a couple of short samples. He works for ABC, of course, but he makes jokes about everybody. One was, and I'm not telling this as well as Jimmy Kimmel, NBC renewed Law & Order SVU, which is coming back for a 21st season. And that is amazing to think about. That means that babies born the year that show started are now old enough to commit sex crimes of their own. Some of these, Matt, are very off color, and that is not even close to the most off color. Let me try one more. He's talking about Disney's new streaming service. He says, the new service isn't free. Basically, parents, you have a choice. You can either pay $7 a month for Disney Plus, or you can raise your children yourselves. I think that one's quite, cuts pretty close to home for a lot of parents.
Oh, for me, for sure. I mean, I'm counting the days until these Disney movies on Netflix disappear and there is anarchy in my home.
Now, Disney, of course, that presentation was a real emblem of not only what's happened with Disney, which acquired Fox and is busting with content, but in terms of just the overall marketplace now, it's so quaint, the days when it was network presentations, and then eventually there were a few other cable channels and it grew. Disney was like this emblem of where the business is right now.
Yeah, it used to be that you cared what the fall schedule was. Now the upfronts are a much larger platform for the state of the industry. And right now, for the most part, the state of the industry is streaming services. But they still have to care about the ad market. The ad market is a $20 billion a year business. And it's actually either flat or growing slightly based on the fact that there are fewer safe places to put advertising right now. And you have to use television if you want to hit a mass market. So we're in this transition moment right now where the industry is evolving, but we still have this legacy business that is gigantic. And you have to serve both masters right now. And that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, I want to do a shout out to our colleague, Dan Feinberg. He wrote a piece about the Disney presentation because it was everything. And I thought it was a very brilliantly written post that he did. And he's comparing being at the Disney upfront to a trip to Golden Corral. He says, you know, it's like this awesome thing. I'm quoting him now. Who doesn't like walking down one aisle for candied bacon, getting updated on a new season of Fargo, stopping for a brief salad bar detour, hearing about a renewal of the bold type leading up to the chocolate fountain, and closing with Jimmy Kimmel accurately warning that broadcast TV is dead and the only prophet who sees the light is Constance Wu, which, by the way, of course, is a reference to a kerfuffle when Constance Wu's show, Fresh Off the Boat, was renewed and she not very advisedly, went on Twitter and said she was very angry and weeping because it turned out she was losing out on another project she wanted to do. That was one of the kerfuffles of the upfront season right now.
And it is like a buffet. I mean, Disney's presentation was over 2 hours, and the ABC portion was the very end, almost an afterthought. And even 10 years ago, that would have seemed unfathomable. All of these different brands, that from FX to Nat Geo to Freeform, all of these outlets are now under one umbrella, and it allows Disney to pitch itself as the scale that you need as an advertiser to reach this mass amount of audience in an environment when Facebook and Google and Amazon are doing the same thing and saying, why would you piddle around with a broadcast network and the 3 million people that are watching The Voice? Come to Facebook, where there are hundreds of millions that you could target in a smarter way.
Yeah, that was a very heavy, apparently long presentation, which, you know, people can get restless in those things. Fox did it a few years ago, and I think people are still traumatized, and it wasn't nearly the kind of universe that Disney's dealing with. Now, one of the other controversies that was swirling around happened at the CBS Bacon and Egg Breakfast, which is a longstanding tradition. It used to be a highlight when Leslie Moonves would always show up when he was head of CBS, and reporters liked him, and he was smart and funny, and he would chat with everybody and make plenty of time, and everybody enjoyed that. This year, and this is just reporters in a room, not this huge presentation for advertisers at Lincoln Center, this year, Kelly Call, who was the head of scheduling and is now setting the primetime schedule, was asked about Bull, this show starring Michael Weatherly, where Eliza Dushku was written out after she complained about alleged harassment, and what CBS did after, you know, many allegations of many problems regarding how CBS has been vis-a-vis women. They wrote her out. He stayed, and Kelly Call was asked about this, and he basically said, well, Michael Weatherly learned his lesson.
Yeah, and the fact that Steven Spielberg's company, Amblin Entertainment, pulled out of the show after this whole controversy because it didn't want to be associated with it. And CBS renewed the show anyways, kept Michael Weatherly as the star. And the message essentially is, if you are on CBS and you are abusive to one of your colleagues, you can apologize and we'll all move on.
Yeah, I'm sure Kelly Call would object to that characterization, but that's kind of the optics of it. And, you know, this is not where we thought we would be with Time's Up. Like, oh, we'll write the woman out of the show and the guy can say, I'm sorry. And I've learned so much while I'm making this money. So let me just quickly mention that another piece of significant news during the upfront is that Comcast is ultimately selling its stake in Hulu, and Disney will run Hulu, which again adds to that ridiculously mighty Disney giganticness. And so that is going to be a change and give Disney another streaming outlet. And I will also note another, I think, potentially significant piece of news, which is that the Verve talent agency has said that it might break ranks on this fight with the writers and agree with the demands of the writers on in terms of packaging fees, and they're not in production, so no big sacrifice there. And, you know, if you're seeing that kind of thing happen, and they do represent significant writers, could be trouble.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because Verve is in an interesting place. It is a smaller talent agency that caters to writers and directors. And from what I'm told, about 70% of its revenue comes from its writer clients. And that's a big chunk to lose when all of your clients are essentially firing you en masse. So it makes sense that Verve would reconsider its position. It is not a member of the Association of Talent Agents, and it can do this without, you know, turning its back on the rest of the industry if, and this is a big if, it doesn't upset the ecosystem and have the rest of the representation industry coming after them and trying to punish them for this move. And they haven't done it yet, but I would not be surprised if Verve becomes the first signatory on a version of the code of conduct.
Yeah, I would guess that punishment would be very much on the mind of agents based on the ones I've been talking to. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Postscript, since we recorded the banter, Verve, in fact, adopted that policy. The documentary Minding the Gap starts as a look at young skateboarders in Rockford, Illinois. Life is coming at these young men fast, and all they really want to do is skate.
We have to fully grow up, and it's going to suck.
When you're a kid, you just do. You just act. And then somewhere along the line, everyone loses that.
The film checks in with the boys, filmmaker Bing Liu himself, and his friends, Kier and Zach, from time to time as the years go by. We learn that fun-loving Zach is about to be a dad, but he's still grappling with his own difficult childhood.
You know, my parents ran this very controlling house, and so I ran away a lot. By like 16, I was no longer living with my parents, like, at all.
Meanwhile, Kier is just beginning to talk very tentatively about his own troubled youth.
How did you get disciplined?
I mean, well, they call it child abuse now, but...
Minding the Gap filmmaker Lou uses 12 years of Verite footage to tell the stories of himself and his friends, each coming of age in the shadow of abuse. Lou started making Minding the Gap as a teenager. He had no idea what it would eventually become, an Oscar-nominated documentary and a Peabody Award winner. I'm a member of the Peabody jury, and while I'm away attending the gala where Minding the Gap will be honored, it seemed like a good time to revisit a conversation with Lou. He sat down with KCRW's Matt Holzman last summer.
So how did you originally pick up the camera?
I saw like a couple of friends who were from the Chicago suburbs who I met. And they took skate video filming, like, really seriously. Like, a friend of mine had, like, a Hi8 camera, you know, in middle school. And it's like, yeah, we dinked around and filmed a little bit.
Like a Sony Handycam.
Yeah. But, like, these guys, they had Sony Handycams as well, but they were, like, bigger. Oh. You know, they had, like, fish eyes that were just cost just as much as the camera. They were careful about the music they chose. They took a long time to edit. And these kids were, like, 14 or 15, you know?
Wow.
And I was like, oh, my God. And so I wanted to get a camera. So I got a camera off eBay, borrowed some money from my mom, and saved up some money for my dishwashing job and bought a little soccer mom camera.
Am I right that I kind of remember hearing saying that you actually broke your arm at one point? It was like, well, I can't skate for a little while, so maybe I'll just film my friends.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like sort of this message from the universe that, you know, like, you suck. Like, maybe you shouldn't. No, I mean, but it was a really bad break. It was a compound fracture, both my radius and my ulna. Took a long time both to heal and also like to be able to like bend my elbow again. So
oh wow.
Yeah.
So you actually ended up becoming a professional cameraman though.
Yeah. I was 23 when I joined the camera union. And then I just, you know, started working in the camera department for a long time. And then while I was doing that, I started shooting in indie films. And
this is all in Chicago.
Mostly in Chicago. I mean, I'd go to New York and LA sometimes to do work, but mostly in Chicago. Yeah.
Now how old are you now?
29.
Okay, so over the last 5 years or so, how have you mostly made your living? Like, what have you worked on?
You know, everything from Chirac, the movie, to Shameless, the TV show, to car commercials, to being a camera operator in a documentary for a couple days. It's just been all over the map. I got my big directorial break when Steve James hired me in 2015 to direct three stories on his massive education series called America to Me. And that was awesome.
We're going to talk about that in a sec. I want to talk about your film. Minding the Gap is a film set in Rockford where you grew up. And it's a film that features a ton of skateboard footage. I mean, it's not about skateboarding, but it's about a bunch of kids who do skateboard, including yourself. And one of the things that makes the film so lyrical, and it's about really serious stuff, but it kind of makes it much lighter, is the fact that you have all this beautiful skateboard footage. And I'm just wondering, like, was that just you with your camera catching all that footage?
Well, first of all, if you did the math, it's probably like 10 or 15 minutes of skateboarding footage in the film. But because it's so different from, I think, what you usually see skateboarding as, that's what makes it feel like, you know, there's more of it than there actually is.
That's interesting. It's also really beautiful.
Yeah.
And also very, because a lot of the content is so kind of heart-wrenching when you see these characters skateboarding and you feel the freedom of that, it's kind of like you take a big deep breath. So maybe that's also why it feels so important.
Well, it was shot with the glide cam. I was running on foot, glide cam, DSLR, 16 millimeter lens.
Is that just a kind of a version of a steady cam?
It's a version of a steady cam, same physics. You know, what keeps it steady is gravity. What allows you to pan and tilt effortlessly is a gimbal. And, you know, what it does physically is that it transfers all the shake and weight to your body. But this was, you know, very light thing where I could like unscrew it in three pieces and put it in a backpack and just run around with it.
So how did this movie come about? You're making a living as a cinematographer, as a camera operator, and you decide you're going to make your own film.
Well, I mean, it wasn't my first film. I did a 20-minute doc about these two Vietnamese immigrants that dealt with identity and family trauma. I made a film that emulated the film Slacker when I was 17. Made a film that emulated the film Crash when I was 19. It actually got me a partial scholarship to go to film school, but it was still too expensive. So I went to school for English. And then Minding the Gap was just another side project of mine. You know, it started out as a film. It was about skateboarders' relationships with their families, with their fathers, you know, with their emotions. And then a year into it, I met Kier and Zach and decided to follow them. Mm-hmm. I should say I reconnected with Zach. But Kier, it was really like I was meeting him for the first time.
Right, because this is a film that has a bunch of footage of them and you when you're all very young. But I get the sense that you just happened to catch that because they were kids out there skateboarding like you were, not necessarily because you guys were close.
Yeah, I mean, Zach and I hung out a little bit. You know, I met him when I was 17 and I was a couple of years older. But then I moved to Chicago when I was 19. So, you know, we didn't really get to build a connection. Kier is 7 years younger than me. You know, I caught him a couple times at the skate park, but I had to source most of Kier's footage from other people.
Mm.
But they both knew who I was. I was the one who was like, you know, taking 5 years to edit a skate video. And it's like, oh, I want to be in Bing's video. So when I came back, they were probably really psyched to be filmed by me and then probably weirded out that I wanted to follow all these other aspects of their lives.
Documentary is casting, right? And you cast this brilliantly because they're such great characters and they bring so much to it. But why initially did you decide to go with these two guys?
Kier has an emotional openness, but at the time when I first started following him, he had all these unresolved things that he never talked about in terms of both his relationship with his father, but also in terms of his racial identity. He was talking about it for the first time, but he was so like on the fence. You know, he'd talk about things that his father did to him that made him angry, but he wouldn't let himself feel that anger completely. Mm-hmm. He'd waver between that and, you know, this intense love and respect that he had for his father. And I think that ultimately, that's what I saw a lot of my younger self in him.
And in terms of race, I mean, he's one of the only black kids skating amongst a lot of white kids.
I mean, that was why I actually wanted to interview him the first time. And then all this other stuff came out. But he sort of brushed that off too. You know, he started talking about these things that made him feel uncomfortable that his friends did or said to him or called them. But he would always like justify it for them. He'd excuse them. He'd rationalize it. And I saw myself in that too, because it's sort of a survival mechanism when you're a person of color in a group of white friends. It's like you have to find a way to fit in and make them feel okay with this elephant in the room. And over time, you know, he sort of realizes like, no, that's not okay. You know, it matters a lot actually in the wider world that I'm black. And I had to have that realization as well.
So it does seem in watching the movie that you as a character, and we'll talk about you deciding to put yourself in the film, that all three of you kind of open up as time goes by, not necessarily even to the camera, but to yourselves. You're all kind of admitting to yourselves the things that have happened to you and how much they've affected your lives. And you kind of see that unfold.
Yeah, it's weird. Like this time in your life when you're an adolescent, you know, when you're a teenager, when you're in your early 20s, all that stuff matters, you know. And I think oftentimes we brush off the emotional up and downs of that era of our lives. But really, like that, those are the things that formulate who we become as adults. You know, we enter our 20s and our 30s and like jobs and school, career, family. And then all of a sudden we're like old. And
hey,
and
easy.
Sorry. No, yeah. You know, but like in actuality, yeah, these monolithic things that happen, they feel monolithic, you know, when you're an adolescent, when you get your first car or when you talk about your father for the first time. And we shouldn't brush that stuff off.
Yeah.
And that was the processing that happened.
Was there any ground rules in filming Kier and Zach? Because I know at one point Zach is getting high and he kind of looks over his shoulder and he looks at the camera and he says, hey, you're going to use me getting high? And you say, maybe.
Are you going to put me smoking weed in the thing?
Maybe. Dude, I don't think just like, to do it.
I've given you free range. I mean, I have no stipulation.
And did you have any ground rules going when you started filming them?
No, I mean, I feel like we were beyond in the storytelling community. I think we're beyond, you know, this pretending that this fourth wall exists and, you know, like we're just going to move forward and, you know, this is actually just them and their natural element. I grew up in the time of postmodern, you know, storytelling. I was just obsessed with the idea of meta. I think that maybe that's something that has to do with my generation too, this millennial generation.
Mm.
It's like embracing how cameras and perspective affects the story is a more interesting question than pretending like it doesn't affect the story.
Well, that's interesting because the film is basically verite, and I know that you're very much kind of follow the edicts of verite filmmaking. And so in a way, it's not meta, but there are certainly these moments, and probably the most obvious moment is the interview with your mom, where you see the presence of the camera. In fact, you had another camera crew there filming you, filming her. But at the beginning, you weren't going to put yourself in the film at all. There was a little nod. There's a moment where you kind of nod to the fact that you too experienced some of the things that your other characters experienced when they were kids. If, especially for a person who likes the meta, why weren't you going to put yourself in the film?
I like meta in the sense of it having a purpose, but I didn't set out to make a film about myself. Like, that's a different film. That's a different genre. That's a personal doc. Mm-hmm. And I never intended to make a personal doc. There's something that happened in the film that gave me a reason to do it. And it wasn't like, you know, this thing happened. It's like, okay, now I'm going to put myself in the film. It was like this thing happened and it brought up a lot of ethical questions. And I think, you know, in revealing the filmmaking, it sort of helped enrich those ethical questions to the point where it's not just an ethical question. It's like, oh no, this is interesting. Like, we have to pay attention to, you know, how the story is told in situations like this. I know I'm being very vague, but...
Well, we'll just say that you find out that there is abuse happening in a relationship amongst your other characters. And in fact, your mother was abused, you were abused, and your stepbrother, Kent, was abused. So including them in the story seemed like you kind of didn't have a choice in a way.
Well, there's parallels between issues of violence in the home, domestic violence, child abuse, and filmmaking. And in both, like, you have to deal with the question of privacy. I think they aligned really well by, you know, addressing both privacy in those relationships and those characters' lives and also in the filmmaking. Mm.
So that's a very intellectual, academic way of putting it. But then you had to ask your mom to sit down and talk with her about things that are really, really difficult. Yeah. How'd you ask her to sit down and talk about that stuff?
I think I just sent her an email saying, hey, mom, can I interview you for my project? And she was like, yeah. And then we just, I think like the next five emails were about choosing a date.
So as simple as that, there wasn't a big emotional upheaval about that.
No, I mean, our relationship, like, and maybe it's our personalities. Like, we're very much just like open people and we just take it as it comes.
Or you're not dealing with what's really happening underneath.
Actually, yeah. And beneath that, we are not dealing with things.
Right.
I think us not dealing with it was not conscious. Like, you know, we weren't conscious of it. So,
right.
Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, Minding the Gap director Bing Liu tells us how the band The Mountain Goats changed his life and why the group is part of the reason his film ended up at Hulu. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting a conversation between KCRW's Matt Holzman and Bing Liu, director of the award-winning coming-of-age documentary, Minding the Gap. Minding the Gap started out as a movie about skateboarding in down-on-its-luck Rockford, Illinois. But as Kier, one of the film's young subjects, explains, skateboarding was much more than a hobby.
I could seriously be on the verge of having a mental breakdown, but as long as I'm able to go skate, I'm completely fine.
Minding the Gap follows filmmaker Bing Liu and his friends Kier and Zach over more than a decade as they move through a tough adolescence. Through all their ups and downs, skateboarding remains a constant. Liu gathered footage for years and went on to become a professional camera operator, mostly in and around Chicago. That's where he encountered documentary giant Steve James, whose company gave Minding the Gap a huge boost.
Steve James is one of the great documentary filmmakers of today, a man who originally came to most people's attention for co-directing Hoop Dreams. But he is part of the Chicago Film Collaborative, Kartemquin Films. And at some point, you connected with Kartemquin. How did that happen?
I had heard about a fellowship that they had called Diverse Voices in Documentary that helped filmmakers of color who had a project that they already started. So I applied, I think like maybe with like 2 days to spare from the deadline. I was like, oh, cool, I'll just try it. And then I got in. And then, yeah, over time, they workshopped the film a little bit. And then afterwards, they loved the project so much, they approached me and were like, hey, can we co-produce this with you? And I think I was like 25 at the time. So I was like, sure, whatever I sign, you know. Right.
There isn't anybody better in the entire doc world to have you co-producing your movie than Kurtempkin,
yes,
right?
Yes, in hindsight, it's like, wow. Yeah. There's nothing like Kurtempkin in the world of documentary. You know, it's really special. It's a really special place.
That's right. No, I have to ask the kind of pedestrian question, but at the end of the day, where did you find the money to make the film?
I must have written like 30 or 40 grants and got denied that many times. But along the way, I would go to things like Tribeca's industry meetings and, you know, I'd go to fellowships and I would just start meeting more and more people. And over time, the film, it was on people's lips more over time.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'd always heard like, once somebody wants to put money into it, everybody else is going to want to jump on it too.
Absolutely.
And there was a lot of truth to that.
Were you showing them a short clip? Did you have a sizzle reel? What were people seeing?
By 2015, I had a rough cut.
Oh, you did?
Some applications asked for a 10-minute thing. Some asked for a rough cut. It just really depended on the grant. So I had a 3-minute sizzle, a 10-minute demo, and then a rough cut.
And that rough cut is what you submitted to Sundance, and you got in.
Yes.
And you received a special award for breakthrough filmmaking. How different was the film that we saw at Sundance from the one that you were showing people a couple of years before?
It's hard.
Yeah, a lot of iterations.
Yeah, I've had so many iterations. I mean, I was just constantly cutting. You know, I was just like cutting in my room. You know, like anytime I had free time, but I didn't have the time to go to Rockford, I'd be cutting. You know, I'd be.
Mm.
Yeah, people at Kurtempkin like always joked about it. It's like how many versions of this thing do you have?
So you actually cannot answer that question.
I literally
question.
Cannot answer. Yeah, I can't.
All right.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Now, in June, Sundance is in January, and in June, Hulu announces that they're going to distribute the film. And I'm wondering, what was happening in those months? Were there feverish negotiations going on, or what was happening in the interim?
Yeah, I mean, this is unprecedented. I mean, so Hulu, they didn't have an originals documentary department until last year. So this is their second year doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So let me back up. POV, which is a PBS strand, you know, they're in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They program amazing documentaries. They were the first people to put money in the film. And that happened in late 2016. And then shortly after, we got ITVS, which is in San Francisco. They're a big PBS funder of independent documentaries. So PBS basically funded the film.
Mm-hmm.
But they had TV rights. So, I mean, that was sort of ultimately what had to be negotiated. And that's what took the time that it did.
That makes things really complicated.
Yeah.
And Hulu was like, okay, we want this film. We're going to work it out however we have to work it out.
Yeah. I mean, we had our first meeting at Sundance. I went to like the Hulu condo or whatever. And and we sat down and it was like, yeah, they really talked about how they love the film. They really got it. Melissa Balaban, she and I talked about The Mountain Goats for like half an hour, you know, and how much that music affected us. And that really... Yeah, that made me really like...
The Mountain Goats is the final song in the movie is by the Mountain Goats.
Yeah.
What was the significance of that?
Well, the Mountain Goats is really the brainchild of John Darnielle, and he is just this prolific musician. But in 2007, he put out this album called The Sunset Tree, and it was all about him growing up with this abusive stepfather and how he survived it. And it wasn't sad. It was like... You could like nod your head to it, you know. It was uplifting.
It was kind of We Shall Overcome.
It was like We Shall Overcome. And on the inside sleeve of the CD, it was like, this is for everybody who's survived abuse, and this is to let you know that you will live to tell your tale. And that, as well as the tone of how he talked about violence in the home and childhood, that was like a watershed moment for me when I first listened to that growing up.
You were a person who really got through a lot of tough times with music and movies and
books. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, like when I was part of why I made Mind in the Gap was that I wanted to make a film that I think could help other people survive.
Bing Liu is the director of the new documentary Minding the Gap. It is a beautiful movie. And thank you for coming and talking with us on The Business.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.